This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower by Brittany Cooper, read for you by the author.
The Problem with Sass. This is a book by a grown-ass woman written for other grown-ass women. This is a book for women who expect to be taken seriously and for men who take grown women seriously. This is a book for women who know shit is fucked up. These women want to change things but don't know where to begin. To be clear, I'm not really into self-help books, so I don't have one of those catchy three-step plans for changing the world. What I have is anger. Rage, actually. And that's the place where more women should begin, with the things that make us angry. When it comes to Black women, sometimes Americans don't recognize that sass is simply a more palatable form of rage. Americans adore sassy Black women. You know, those caricatures of finger-waving, eye-rolling Black women at whom everyone loves to laugh. Women like Tyler Perry's Madea, Mammy in Gone with the Wind, or Nell from that old 80s sitcom, Give Me a Break. These kinds of Black women put white folks at ease. In my first terrible job after college, my boss, an older white woman, told me that the students at the predominantly Black school at which we worked had deemed her an honorary Black woman. When I looked at her with question marks in my eyes, she said, "You know, they mean the way I talk to them and roll my neck," and demonstrated it for me. I went on back to my desk. Years after that, I was doing a summer abroad in South Korea. My Malaysian roommate, who had seen many episodes of the old 90s sitcom Family Matters, told me that she loved Black women because we were sassy, like Harriet and Laura Winslow, the main Black female characters on that show. To her, these stereotypical portrayals made Black folks seem understandable, even though to me, her descriptions felt like we were exotic others. She loved it, she said, when Black women put their hands on their hips and swiveled their necks in protest. Not wanting to offend this woman who I otherwise really liked, I simply said, "We're not all like that." She looked disappointed. I am fat, Black, and Southern, but this is not a sassy Black girl's tale. Black women turn to sass when rage is too risky, because we have jobs to keep, families to feed, and bills to pay. Black women who hold their communities together also hold our broader American community together. But it's unclear whether we are really being taken seriously. Owning anger is a dangerous thing if you're a fat Black girl like me. Angry Black women get dismissed all the time. We are told we are irrational, crazy, out of touch, entitled, disruptive, and not team players. The story goes that angry Black women scare babies, old people, and grown men. This is absurd, and it is a lie. If you have the nerve to be fat and angry, then you are treated as a bully even if you are doing nothing aggressive at all. The truth is that angry Black women are looked upon as entities to be contained, as inconvenient citizens who keep on talking about their rights while refusing to do their duty and smile at everyone. Don't you just hate when folks yell at you to smile? I told the last man who said that shit to me, "You smile." Some years ago, I ran into a former student on the college campus where I was teaching. Erica was a brilliant Black girl who wrote great papers and asked really smart questions. As we were standing around with a group of others chatting, she said, "I loved having you as my professor. Your lectures were filled with rage, but it was like the most eloquent rage ever." I immediately felt defensive. What did she mean by rage? "I'm not angry," I told her. "I'm passionate." By then, I was wary of the angry Black woman stereotype. Even though I was only in my mid-20s at the time, I had already experienced many years of white people doing that thing they do to articulate Black women, always asking us, "Why are you so angry?" I hated the accusation from others, usually white people, because it was unfair, a way to discredit the legitimacy of the things Black women say by calling them emotional and irrational. But Erica was a Black girl. She fixed me with a telltale look that only another Black woman can give you, a look that said, "Girl, be for real." And then she said, "Brittany, you know you're angry." I felt exposed. I couldn't even say anything. She had seen through the veneer, seen the lie I was telling. It was devastating and life-changing. I was angry as hell, and I was fooling no one. Black women have the right to be mad as hell. We have been dreaming of freedom and carving out spaces for liberation since we arrived on these shores. There is no other group save Indigenous women that knows and understands more fully the soul of the American body politic than Black women, whose reproductive and social labor have made the world what it is. This is not mere propaganda. Black women know what it means to love ourselves in a world that hates us. We know what it means to do a whole lot with very little, to make a dollar out of 15 cents, as it were. We know what it means to snatch dignity from the jaws of power and come out standing. We know what it means to face horrific violence and trauma from both our communities and our nation state and carry on anyway. But we also scream and cry and hurt and mourn and struggle. We get heartbroken. Our feelings get stepped on. Our dreams get crushed. We get angry and we express that anger. We know what it means to feel invisible. I know what it means to feel invisible, to be picked on, bullied, misunderstood, and dismissed. But when Erica called me out on my anger, it was clear that she saw me in a way that I wasn't particularly interested in being seen. She helped me to realize that my anger could be a powerful force for good. She had called my rage eloquent, clear, expressive, to the point. In her estimation, it had made me a good teacher, and it had inspired her and other students. Over and over again, Black girls have called me out and demanded that I get my shit together around my rage, around my work in the world, and around my feminism. Those Black girl call-outs, or homegirl interventions, as I call them in this book, have come from my grandmama, my mama, and my girls, and they have saved my life. America needs a homegirl intervention in the worst way. So in this book, I am doing what Black women do best. I'm calling America out on her bullshit about racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, and a bunch of other stuff. And I'm using feminism to stage this homegirl intervention. I'm here for picket signs, pussy hats, as long as there are plenty of brown ones in the mix, and patchouli. My picket signs are as likely to say fuck the police as they are to say fuck the patriarchy. Black girl feminism is all the rage, and we need all the rage. Feminism can give us a common language for thinking about how sexism and racism and classism work together to fuck shit up for everybody. Like many other feminists, I used to carry around Audre Lorde's book Sister Outsider like it was the feminist Bible. Her essay, The Uses of Anger, Women Responding to Racism, taught me that rage is a legitimate political emotion. She writes, "Focused with precision, it can become a powerful source of energy, serving progress and change." Here's the thing. My anger and rage haven't always been focused with precision. The process of both becoming a feminist and becoming okay with rage as a potential feminist superpower has been messy as hell. We need to embrace our messiness more. We need to embrace the ways we are in process more. Very often, Black girls don't get the opportunity to be in process. So just know that you don't have to have everything figured out to read and enjoy this book. For more than a decade since Erica named for me my superpower, eloquent rage, I've been trying to figure out how to focus it with precision. When I watch the Williams sisters, Venus and Serena, use their power on a tennis court, I feel like they are a case study in how to use rage with precision. Born 6 months after Venus and 9 months before Serena, I feel like I grew up with the Williams sisters. When they first began to win major tournaments in the late 1990s, sportscasters derisively referred to the power tennis they played. These strong, athletic Black girls had serves with speeds of more than 120 miles per hour, and they scared the shit out of white girls. Until they learned how to use their power, it often became a liability, causing them to make lots of mistakes on and off the court. But in the nearly 20 years since they have come to dominate tennis, both sisters have figured out how to corral all that power into precise serves and shots that are nearly unmatched. They have created this kind of alchemy that uses their physical strength and strategic prowess on the court, together with all the racial slurs and insults they have endured over the years. Being called the N-word, being called ugly, being told their bodies were too manly, to create something that looks magical to the rest of us. Watching Venus play, particularly on grass courts, is like watching a black girl perform in a ballet. She is an elegant player. Watching Serena play, particularly when she's beating white women, is like watching eloquent rage personified. Her shots are clear and expressive. Her wins are exultant. Her victories belong to all of us, even though she's the one who does all the work. That's kind of how it feels to be a black woman. Like our victories belong to everyone, even though we do all the work. But here's the thing. If I can master any force in my life and slay it like Serena slays tennis balls on the court, then I'm happy to share the wealth. Capital B, capital F. It took nothing short of a homegirl intervention to turn me into a feminist. It was my senior year at Howard University, and I'd managed to go through much of college without having even one boyfriend on campus. As much as Howard offered an explicit education in the workings of racism and white supremacy, its lessons about sexism were far more subtle. I felt like something was wrong with me. The boys wanted me to run their student government campaigns, or they wanted to verbally joust with me, but they didn't want to date me. On high self-esteem days, I simply thought it was because they were dumb. On bad self-esteem days, I thought it was because I was fat. Fat is, of course, relative, because if I could be my college size again. I hadn't considered that sexism had anything to do with it, that young men had been socialized to desexualize outspoken women. I reveled in being unconquerable, because that's an important trait for black girls surviving abusive father figures to have. I didn't realize that living life in a patriarchy, even in a beautiful black one, meant that I had to at least appear conquerable if I wanted to get chose. One day on campus, I proclaimed with the confidence of a 20-year-old who knows just enough to be dangerous that feminism is white women's shit. At most, I'm a womanist. I had heard someone else invoking Alice Walker's definition of womanism, and it sounded good enough to me. The thing is, my defection from feminism wasn't a principled defection. I hadn't read Walker's definition at all, but I had spent a lifetime having slightly awkward friendships with the white girls with whom I grew up, and I had escaped after high school to the blackness of Howard to recover from all of it. I'll talk more about my complicated relationship with white women in the next chapter, but suffice it to say that I was ready to lay the entirety of my feminist inheritance, the work of women like Sojourner Truth, Anna Julia Cooper, Ida B. Wells, and the women of the Combahee River Collective, on the altar next to all the blonde hair that I had mentally burned in effigy after high school. This is what I like to call doing the most, but achieving the least. And luckily, one of my homegirls saw through my bullshit and staged a friendly but serious intervention. My friend Tracy heard me making such ignorant pronouncements about feminism and hemmed me up in the dorms later. "Here," she said, handing me a book. "Read this, because you were talking kind of crazy earlier about feminism." This wasn't our first discussion about the F word. She had also asked me a few months earlier if I wanted to come to Blackburn, the student center, to hear bell hooks. "Who is bell hooks?" I had asked, vaguely remembering that I had encountered her name in a book on gender and equality that I had bought during my days on my high school's debate team. "Oh, she writes all this feminist stuff, but she talks real crazy, so it should be interesting," Tracy had said, chuckling. Talking crazy, in our college parlance, could be either an indictment or a compliment. It was a way to denote those moments of flirtation with ideas that skirted the line between being profound and being absolutely nonsensical. For instance, there was the day that the honors office crew, the blurs of my day, entertained the idea of whether women might evolve into being able to impregnate themselves if it happened to be true that clitorises were really just small penises. My good Christian self was both scandalized by the mention of clitorises and penises and evolution, but also deeply curious and seduced by the questions themselves. I vacillated between wondering whether my friends were going to hell and tiptoeing into the deep with them because I secretly loved the irreverence of it all. It felt like any day in the Howard Honors Office could lead to a personal evolution of Big Bang proportions. Listening to years of talking crazy among the crew had made me fall in love with ideas in a substantive way. For instance, the crew put me on to Ta-Nehisi Coates back in the early 2000s when he wrote for the Washington City Paper. His pieces were must-reads, and when we saw him hanging out on campus, we whispered to each other, standing ever so slightly. Once, I remember Coates popping his head into a room of Howard student leaders in the Blackburn Center and scowling at us, unimpressed. We were probably having a heated debate about the fate of Black America, and apparently we weren't saying anything earth-shattering. I'm pretty sure I scowled back. Still, it was cool as hell to run into thinkers on campus whose work I'd read on the regular. I became a PhD because I wanted that kind of life, one where talking crazy, playing with ideas that skirted the line between the radical and the absurd, the sacred and the profane, was the order of the day. So I knew that in Tracy's indictment of Hook's propensity to talk crazy, there was also an endorsement, a belief that she was worth hearing. Curious about just exactly what kind of crazy talk Hooks might engage in, I followed Tracy to the panel. I don't remember much about Hooks' talk. Perhaps we had arrived late. I do remember that she seemed unimpressed and perhaps agitated, most likely with the conservative gender politics that shaped Howard during my time there. But Hooks' feminist crazy talk was my first experience with the kinds of provocations that can be life-changing. And it was quite different from the dismissive crazy talk that had me in the hot seat with my homegirl. I think Tracy had just assumed, naturally, that I would be a feminist, given my fierce sense of selfhood and my willingness to drag anyone who stepped to me with what I deemed a bad argument. She therefore looked at me both curiously and incredulously when I dared to insist otherwise. I took the book, a collection of academic essays on feminist theory. She instructed, "I think you'll really like this essay on multiple jeopardies by Deborah King." Sufficiently chastised, I agreed to read the piece she had chosen. While I was not especially interested in being a feminist, I was even less interested in having a raggedy analysis, of being critically uninformed, and of getting caught out there, asked out, and looking ignorant. So I sat down that same night, turned to the essay Tracy had suggested, and tried to get clearer on what exactly feminism was and how it might apply to me. King wanted us to see the effects of oppressions on Black women's lives as what she called multiplicative. Our class position, sexual identity, and many other vectors of power shaped our identity in the world. And more specifically, these things determined how many boots there were on our collective necks. That essay didn't turn me into a feminist because it felt a bit too academic for me to read without the benefit of a classroom context to work out the ideas. But I did begin to care deeply about Black women's legacy of activism and ask more questions about what historical Black women had said about issues of racism and sexism. Over the next few years, I would have the opportunity, via some dope-ass Black feminist professors and because of the work of hip-hop feminist Joan Morgan, to name and own a feminism for myself. But what mattered to me most, what lingers for me now, was the thoughtfulness and care of another Black girl's friendship. Friendships with Black girls have always saved my life. I give the side eye to any Black woman who doesn't have other Black women friends, to any woman who is prone to talk about how she relates better to men than to women, to anyone who goes on and on about how she doesn't trust females. If you say fuck the patriarchy, but you don't ride for other women, then it might be more true that the patriarchy has fucked you, seducing you with the belief that men care more about your well-being than women do. It isn't true. I came up in an era when Black girls loudly proclaimed that they didn't have friends. They had associates. It has always rung false to me, maybe because the introverted parts of me had absolutely no interest in spending sustained time fake grinning at people with whom I couldn't be my whole self. I wanted friends to snicker, giggle, and pass notes with, to share secrets with. I wanted people who would have my back. I worry about a world in which Black girls on their way to becoming women are taught to distrust women. I worry about a world in which Black women who are raising boys cultivate distrust for girls by looking upon every girl who shows interest in their sons with distrust. We wonder why young men hate women, and sometimes the sad truth is that their mamas and aunts and sisters act as an arm of the patriarchy by parroting the refrain that girls simply can't be trusted. It's hard for Black girls to be friends with each other. But there is wonder-working power in the homegirl hem-up, the particular way that Black women friends gather you and save your life by telling you lovingly to get your shit together. It took me a really long time to find my tribe, though. I always knew I needed Black girls to make it, and I longed for their friendship in substantial ways throughout childhood. But more often than not, I was rebuffed. We live in a world that tells women to distrust other women. And those of us who do dare to love other women hard are taught to distrust our impulses, to see that love as queer and wrong. I've had more than a few crushes on my homegirls, mostly intellectual and always deeply emotional, and sometimes perhaps a bit sexual. In middle school, when I finally found my first real deal pass notes in class, rush home after school to talk on the phone for several more hours, black girl bestie, I was elated and a bit surprised. Nisha had sidled up to me one day at the end of seventh grade as we were walking out the doors toward the buses after school and said, "We're going to have to stick together next year." Up until that point, I didn't totally know how I felt about her. She was both smart and cool. I had smart unlocked, but couldn't find my own cool, even if someone had handed it to me in a paper bag. Nisha and I had come to know each other better a few weeks earlier on our seventh grade honors trip to South Louisiana, a place that seemed a world away from our more rural North Louisiana experience. On the trip, we bonded over an episode of Martin featuring his next-door neighbor Shanene and her homegirls Bonquisha and Kilolo. Together with Raina, a black girl whom I had known since I was 8, when we ended up in Girl Scouts together, the three of us, the only black girls on the trip, stuck together. For some reason, perhaps because of the insecurities that plague all girls at age 12, occasionally Nisha and Raina would devolve into mean girl behaviors with me as the target. Just happy to have black girls for friends, I pretended not to hear the commentary they made behind my back about how corny I was or how naive I was. One day in eighth grade, after Nisha and I became actual besties, I heard her walking behind me in the hall, whispering to someone about why I had worn hot pink scrunch socks instead of white tights with a cute skirt I rocked to school that day. My feelings were hurt. I pretended like I simply didn't hear her. A confrontation would surely have ended our friendship. One of the final outings of the Louisiana Heritage Tour in 1993 was a trip to New Orleans Audubon Zoo, the biggest zoo in our state. Our teachers had given strict instructions that we were to use the buddy system. Nisha, Raina, and I, together with James, the only black boy on the trip, decided we would navigate the zoo together. None of us had been especially tight before we had boarded the buses that Monday, but by that Thursday afternoon, the trip to the plantation, one in which tour guides acted shy about admitting that enslaved people had lived and worked there, had brought us together. Apparently, my endless chatter or my inability to be as appropriately cool and detached as 12-year-old me should have been got on the nerves of Raina and Nisha for the last time. At some point, I turned around and they had ditched me, abandoning the buddy system and leaving me to find my way back to the bus. Looking around frantically, I spotted them several yards up ahead, snickering and giggling to themselves as they assumed they had gotten away with their mean joke. Not wanting to be lost, I followed slowly behind, keeping them in sight so that I wouldn't be late to the bus. But since they wanted to be away from me, I didn't catch up to them either. I walked along humiliated that I needed them to find my way back and afraid to call out their behavior for fear that the friends I had finally found would no longer be my friends. I wondered what it was that I had done to make them hate me. I arrived back at the bus a few moments after they did, but we never spoke about how they had left me in the middle of a jungle without backup. I knew I wasn't ready to ditch them and go it alone again, so there was no point in making a scene. A few weeks later, apparently Nisha had reassessed her view of me, deciding that we would in fact need each other next year. Post-30-year-old me wishes I had had the nerve to tell her to shove it, but I really did need her, and she really did need me. We were overachieving black girls in predominantly white classrooms, and what that trip to learn about our heritage had taught us was that our story bound us together and didn't allow us the privilege of building friendships based on shared affinity and personality alone. Black girls had to stick together. So stick we did. We exchanged phone numbers and then spent the summers between 7th and 8th and 8th and 9th grades giggling on the phone endlessly, talking about boys and having phone romances with boys that we connected to through an endless string of three-way calls. Two summers before, it was my white bestie, Mandy, whom I had called to tell when my period showed up a few days before the start of 6th grade. But sharing the secrets of growing into my black womanhood with my white bestie, when our social lives were increasingly racially segregated, made for an unsustainable friendship by the end of middle school, causing Mandy and I to grow apart. By the summer of 93, it was my black bestie Nisha I'd called to talk about the harrowing events of the night before when my mother's live-in boyfriend, angry over their impending breakup, beat her, forcing me to choose between grabbing a knife and calling the police. I was thankful that I had a black girl to call, and I realized that if circumstances had been different, I wouldn't have told Mandy at all. Nisha's family was different from mine. She had a married mama and daddy and two big brothers who lived in the house with her. Still, I felt like she would understand more. And she did. She listened and offered support. Perhaps that is why my mother, slightly embarrassed and incensed with me for telling her business, let it ride. Black girls of every age need other Black girls who can hold their truths. I was deep in the throes that summer of my girlhood crush on Ronnie Groves, a nerdy Black boy who was 2 years older and who had beaten me in Bible quiz at Vacation Bible School 2 summers prior. My head and diary were filled with hopes and wishes that he would be my first kiss. I was surprised and unprepared for the moment when I found myself fantasizing about kissing Nisha, having picked up from the ether rather than any particular conversation that girls didn't kiss girls. Up until college, I had only ever encountered one lesbian, a woman named Wendy, whom all the adults in my life seemed to like and respect and smile at when she was around. But as soon as she was out of earshot, they would whisper about how she went the other way. Wendy rocked a jerry curl, drove a long green car, and always had on shades, which she wore looking back on it, like armor. I simply thought she looked a little mysterious. She had a pretty smile and a friendly demeanor, but it was clear to me that she existed on the outskirts of our small, tightly knit community because she was different. Liking girls didn't seem like a viable possibility for me. Fantasies of kissing Nisha weren't frequent, but the closer I felt to her, the more I imagined what physically expressing that closeness might look like. Thankfully, or perhaps not, my mother paid for monthly subscriptions to all the great teen magazines of the 90s, Sassy, Teen, 17, and YM. YM was my fave, and Sassy, the most feminist of them all, was my least fave. Wokeness has been a process for me. So I turned to the monthly advice columns every month and read questions that readers would write into the mag about sex. My boyfriend and I were messing around one day, and he was inside me a little bit. Am I still a virgin? While I found that question quite scandalous, I was relieved when I read this question. Sometimes I think about what it would be like to kiss another girl. Does this mean I'm gay? No, the columnist replied. Your body is changing and you are having lots of feelings. It's perfectly normal in the sexual development process to fantasize about members of the same sex. But don't worry about it. You're probably not gay and you'll figure it out in time. The magazines worked to assure girls that they were most probably straight, subtly making it clear that queerness was not desirable. But back then, conversations about queerness and gender fluidity hadn't trickled down to my Louisiana middle school. You were one or the other, in or out, gay or straight. Relieved and assured of my straightness, I placed Nisha, my one real close Black friend, in the friend-only category and went back to crushing on cute-ass Ronnie Groves. The thing I know today, after many cycles of homegirls, many more years of girl crushes, and a lifetime of straight sexual activity, is that one can't truly be a feminist if you don't really love women. And loving women deeply and unapologetically is queer as fuck. It is erotic in the way that Audre Lorde talks about eroticism. It's an opening up, a healing, a seeing, and being seen. Good sex is all these things, too. My friendships with women have never been overtly sexual, but a good many of them have been what Bell Hooks, in her book Communion, The Female Search for Love, called romantic, in the soul-inspiring way that someone being thoughtful about loving you and showing up for you is romantic. Often those connections have what Hooks called an erotic dimension that acts as an energetic force enhancing and deepening ties. There is no room in my life for shallow or basic connections. Feminism helped me to be okay with what it means to love women in the womanish and womanist ways that Alice Walker famously talked about, sexually and non-sexually. These days, on what one of my homegirls has deemed Thoughty Thursdays, it has become customary for my girls and I to sext one another, slyly seductive pics of our asses or thighs or cleavages, sometimes bare or sometimes clothed in the perfect way that all our curves are accentuated. And the tacit agreement is that we share to be affirmed in our sexiness, in our beauty, and in our glory. When this particular group of homegirls first started with their shameless flirtation and body commentary, I used to blush furiously, not knowing where this kind of engagement fit for me, a straight girl. But for this same me, who has been single, alone, and often lonely for most of my grown womanhood, oftentimes the flirtations and sexy comments from the homies are the only compliments I get. One of the biggest battles that second-wave feminists of the 70s had with third-wave feminists of the 90s was over the place of sex and beauty in feminism. Second-wavers critiqued high heels and lipstick as oppressive expectations of the patriarchy. Third-wave white girls brought heels and fly red lips back into the mix. Black feminists gave the side eye to white girls and their feminist waves because looking fierce and fly has always been a part of the Black girl credo. And also, because Black feminism didn't fit neatly within the historical trajectory of waves. Our embrace of femininity was its own armor in a world where white women said that Black women should never be called ladies. If I have to pick a side, I'd say I'm second wave enough to put my middle fingers up to the patriarchy, and I'm third wave enough to affirm that beauty and the desire to be wanted still matter. When you go for months or years without a dude or any love interest ever noticing you, you can begin to feel invisible. And feminist principles about how the patriarchy has made us beholden to beauty culture do nothing to assuage the desire we all have to be seen and affirmed. The old adage is that all feminists are lesbians. So what if that's true? Here's the thing, and there's really no straight way to say this. Black feminism is and has always been a fundamentally queer project. Straight chicks gotta make their peace with that, and hopefully without too much struggle. I would venture to say that most tried and true feminist chicks are open to the possibility of their own queerness because desire is fluid and because the boundaries and labels matter so much less when you get down to the real work of what it means to love Black women in a world that hates us all. One time, when I revealed to one of my girls that I was post-30, but still hadn't figured out how to have an orgasm that I didn't give myself, she looked at me with a look of incredulity and thinly veiled disgust at the dudes I had slept with and said, "Shit, I'll fuck you." She was only half joking. I didn't take her up on her offer, but I did realize that I needed to seriously invest in my own pleasure, or else I was in for a homegirl intervention of a very different sort. Deep and abiding love can be sisterly and it can be erotic, and sometimes it can be and needs to be all these things at the same damn time. On more than one occasion, I've had a male lover say to me upon finding out I'm a feminist, "Are you a lesbian? Are you sure?" Rather than being reactionary and defensive, perhaps straight women need to become less invested in the project of straightness altogether. Let me be clear. I'm not telling you who to sleep with. I'm also not telling you that all feminists want to or should want to sleep with women. I am saying that far too many women leave behind the freedom feminism offers because they want to stay on patriarchy's dick, which is to say they want to secure their straightness and their options for getting chosen. I love a penis attached to a man who knows how to use it, but I'm uninterested in femme-style battle royales over dick. That's just so basic. Who has time? Feminism wouldn't be feminism if it didn't encode a healthy skepticism about the politics of getting dick. And feminism wouldn't be feminism if it didn't celebrate the power of pussy. It might be trite, but it's true. To be clear, and not transphobic, feminism is also not about the elevation of particular body parts. My trans women comrades have taught me that you don't have to have a vagina to have a pussy. And my lesbian homegirls have extolled to me the virtues of the D their own lesbian partners are throwing down. The larger point is that however dope fellatio may be, fellating the patriarchy is no way to win. If Black women don't figure out how to love other Black women, cis and trans, queer and straight, and everything in between, it will be the death of us. This toxic behavior of not fully knowing how to love other Black women shaped my earliest Black girl friendship with Nisha and shaped many of my other friendships for years to come. I put up with Nisha's mean girl behavior almost until the end of high school. But one summer night, after a minor spat, but after many years of holding in my wounded feelings, I snapped and tried to fight her, only to have Raina hold me back. It's the first and last time I've ever come that close to letting a Black woman catch these hands. Sometimes the sisterhood hurts. This toxicity that dogs Black women in friendships almost ruined my college friendship with Tracy, too. Inexplicably, a few months after pulling my card about feminism, she stopped talking to me. Months later, she said I had become too intense, which I read to mean too close, too attuned, too involved, too much. The subtext, though neither of us ever spoke it out loud, was that I was doing gay shit, and it made her uncomfortable. Perhaps I was. I never imagined kissing Tracy, never wanted to sleep with her. But I loved her deeply, because it's the only way I know how to love Black women. I loved her because she loved me enough to check me when my feminist analysis was raggedy. But Nisha had taught me not to stay in friendships out of fear of being alone. So I endured the homegirl breakup with my chin up as much as I could, which is to say, not very much. One day my roommate Alicia came home and caught me crying big hot tears over this latest friendship failure. Yet again, I had done too much and managed to run off the closest Black friend that I had. Sometimes, Miss Burtney, Alicia's nickname for me. It's not that people don't love you. It's that they don't have the same capacity to love as you do. Most people are doing the best they can. Alicia's words felt wise and true, and they helped me to pick my face up and move on. Months later, Tracy apologized, saying to me, "You simply loved me, and I didn't know how to take it. I hope we can repair our friendship." Intimacy between Black women matters on its own terms, and it isn't a threat to the other kinds of relationships we want to have in our lives. So many Black women of my generation want access to the suburban fantasy marriage more than almost anything else. All I had imagined for my personal life at age 20 was that I would get married, have 3 kids, and enjoy taking care of a family. It's laughable now since I don't particularly like children unless they belong to people I love. I had nuclear family dreams because I had bought into the notion that the way I grew up, in a single-parent home with a mismatched family of aunties and uncles and cousins and grandparents bringing up the rear, was not optimal. So part of my success story involved having it all: the house, the car, the career, the pretty man, and the kids. It's fine to want all those things, but it's dangerous to get them in a context where you have no analysis of how and why those are your desires. Feminism helped me to think more robustly about where I had gotten the idea that my upbringing was wrong or lacking. Moynihan was one place, the church was another, and I'll say more about both of these later. And feminism helped me to recognize that there were other versions of a life to want. When my patriarchal nuclear fantasy didn't happen, and the privileges of straightness eluded me and a whole generation of overachieving Black women, it is my girls who have celebrated my successes, showered me with compliments, taken me out on dates, traveled the world with me, supported me through big life decisions, and showed up when disaster struck. One of feminism's biggest failures is its failure to insist that feminism is first and foremost about truly, deeply, and unapologetically loving women. Beyoncé gets this lesson about feminism better than most, and she has been one of the biggest victims of this failure to love women among Black feminists. Until the release of her magnum opus, Lemonade, an album so self-consciously about the interior lives, struggles, and emotions of Black women that even most of B's haters had to bow down, I have never seen so much vitriol, particularly among Black feminist women, as I have seen in their reactions to Beyoncé. Never. They simply didn't believe that the pretty, light-skinned, affluent, superstar Black girl could really love other Black girls. For most of us, her hashtag pretty privilege conjured up the mean girls we encountered at 12 and 13. That age when we all felt deeply misunderstood and were prone to be mean to others while being the target of other mean girls ourselves. Of course, we are no longer adolescents, but something about seeing Beyoncé shine makes that particular truth go right out the window. We could call it the defenestration of feminist common sense. It's as if the girls who were bullied finally have the chance to be the mean girls, and where Beyoncé is concerned, they have embraced that role with gusto and absolutely no sense of irony. Beyoncé is my feminist muse. She didn't start out that way. Back in 1997, she was just one of the members in a girl group that I loved, singing the soundtrack to my senior year of high school. 3 years later, when 2 of the original group members left, I swore that Beyoncé was the cause and refused to buy any more Destiny's Child albums. But I've always been terrible at holding a grudge, and by the time B dropped her first solo album during the fall of my first year of graduate school, I was back on board. Over the next decade, she became Beyoncé, the multi-talented mega superstar that we know today, largely by keeping Black girls supplied with anthems for every possible life event. She was girl power personified, so I didn't necessarily need or expect her to have a critique of the patriarchy or a formal membership to the feminist club. BTW, for all you card pullers, no such club exists. By then, she was inspiring all of my best feminist theorizing. When I heard the 2006 club track Get Me Bodied, I definitely did an old school dance or two as the song entreated, but I also thought about feminist body politics and what it might mean for a Black girl to really get in her body, love it, and stay there. When I heard Upgrade You, I cringed when she sang, "I can do for you what Martin did for the people, ran by the men," both because of the bad grammar and the even worse politics, but perked up when she said, "But the women keep the tempo." I've thought long and hard about what it means for women's bodies to keep the tempo of social movements. Some of my best academic theorization around feminism has come from pondering what kind of space B might be making for the particular ways in which Black women can be and can lead. At some point, a journalist named Jane Gordon asked her directly whether she was a feminist. Many Black women musicians had been asked this question before B. Erykah Badu and Queen Latifah readily come to mind. Both denied identification with the term, citing an affinity for humanism in Erykah's case and a love for Black men in Latifah's. Beyoncé replied, "I think I am a feminist, in a way. It's not something I consciously decided I was going to be. Perhaps it was because I grew up in a singing group with other women, and that was so helpful to me. It kept me out of so much trouble and out of bad relationships. My friendships with my girls are just so much a part of me that there are things I'm never going to do that would upset that bond. I never want to betray that friendship because I love being a woman and I love being a friend to other women." When I heard Beyoncé articulate friendships with Black women as the core of what feminism was for her, it felt to me like she got the core essence of what this is all about. "I love being a woman and being a friend to other women" should be feminism's tagline. If this isn't true for you, you aren't a feminist. I'm not much on pulling people's feminist cards, but some shit we should just be able to say. Eventually, Beyoncé went on to adopt Chimamanda Adichie's position on feminism in a song called Flawless on her 2013 self-titled album, and which she quoted from a YouTube clip of Adichie's TED Talk. "Feminism refers to the social, political, and economic equality of women. Adichie's own failure in early 2017 to understand that trans women are deserving of this social, political, and economic equality perhaps makes her a problematic feminist icon for many of us. When asked about trans women, Adichie struggled in an interview to acknowledge that trans women are women. Instead, she said, "There are women, and then there are trans women." And while it is okay to acknowledge that all kinds of women, whether white, Black, Indigenous, Latina, Asian, cis, gender nonconforming, trans, queer, bi, or straight, might have different experiences, it's not cool to act as though trans women are in some entirely separate category from the more general category of woman. That is something that feminism needs to be clear on, that it isn't feminism if all women's concerns, particularly the most marginalized women's concerns, aren't taken seriously. When I think about why Beyoncé matters so much to me as a feminist, it is the first definition that always resonates, the one that she seemed hesitant to articulate, the label she seemed ambivalent about adopting. Her feminism of deeply connected relationships is one that escapes notice in our rush to make sure our feminism names every ism and every intersectional category in its articulation. It doesn't matter if we get the rhetoric right, though, if we still keep treating other women wrong. Some would argue that Beyoncé hasn't helped with that. On the very same feminist track, Flawless, the chorus insists, "Bow down, bitches," over an infectious Houston hip-hop beat. Immediately, I watched Black feminist chicks losing their minds, citing their outrage over having someone as powerful as Beyoncé telling them to bow down. This outrage felt rooted in willful ignorance and emotional dishonesty. I'm glad that hip-hop has always been a part of my feminist journey, because I take Joan Morgan's call for a feminism brave enough to fuck with the grays as Bible. You can be deeply invested in loving other Black women, but still need to proclaim sometimes that bitches need to bow down. One, I don't take bitches to be gender specific. Call that a feminist disruption of the sexism inherent in the English language. And two, if I had had Beyoncé's anthems as a 12 or 13 year old, on more than a few occasions, I might have wanted to tell Raina and Nisha to bow down. Loving Black girls is complicated, but loving oneself in a world where there is always someone ready to do you harm is even harder. I'm not trying to resolve the contradiction of proclaiming you love Black women one day and potentially telling them to bow down the next. I'm asking us to sit with the pain and offense that make that space necessary. I'm asking us to sit with the mean girl tendencies we all have, with the ways that we hurt each other and don't show up for each other. I'm asking us to sit with the Beyoncé conundrum that exists for all of us. At least she had the courage to own the messiness of it. And that's why feminism needed Beyoncé. Because she has been more truthful about how hard it is for Black women to get on the same page than any of us professional feminists have ever been. After Beyoncé, feminism was no longer something reserved for black girls with college degrees and PhDs. Suddenly, feminism wasn't just the province of black girls who'd read bell hooks. Armed with feminist narratives in the digital age, this black girl who'd built a singing career instead of going to college could be a feminist too. And she would use her considerable cultural power to spread the gospel of feminism to the masses. I wasn't prepared for the ways many of my black feminist comrades resented her for it. Bell Hooks, the scholar and thinker who made it possible for black girls like me to write books like this, called me a terrorist. She was responding to B's image on the cover of Time magazine, a very blonde, damn near white rendition of B, in which her image approximated white womanhood in ways that felt a little too close for comfort. I think Hooks read B as flirting with whiteness and passing for white in ways that were fundamentally anti-black and not affirming for women of color. I wish that she had said that, rather than throwing around the very loaded language of terrorist all willy-nilly. Another group of black feminists got together and proclaimed B's feminism bottom bitch feminism, the kind of faux feminism that they felt accompanied the politics of sex work. The rage was eloquent, to say the least. It spilled out in think piece after think piece after think piece, attempting to beat back the march of Beyoncé's feminism, like it was the bubonic plague come to wipe out centuries of effort from black women activists. The rage was eloquent, but it wasn't righteous, and mostly it read as just plain wrong to me. Black women with unchecked rage and emotional work left undone can do real harm. Our feminist origin stories matter. When I watched black women deem this girl a brand instead of a human being, a stealthy rhetorical move that enabled them to distance themselves from her and then drag her for filth without compunction, it read to me like grown black women using the power of feminism to punch down or up at the mean girls who they resented in childhood. I'm no therapist, but I'm a black girl's black girl, and I know black girl pain when I see it. Most of us who couldn't access pretty privilege, those of us who weren't popular or cool, those of us nerdy girls who stayed to ourselves, wrote stories, and dreamed of lives as writers, grew up and found a home in feminism, a place where we were seen, a place where others were as mad about injustice as we were. But for many of us, the first real injustices that matter to us, that ripped our hearts out, weren't the failings of our parents' relationships or the boys we crushed on who didn't love us, but the black girls who we wanted to see us and befriend us, instead either ignored or bullied us. I believe B conjures up all that shit, and that feminist analysis gives us the language to bludgeon her with our pain while feeling as if we're doing so in the cause of justice. There is never just cause to beat a black woman like she stole something when she is very clearly taking the pieces of her life and trying to build something magnificent. Misdirected rage is a dangerous thing, a deadly thing. But the power of black feminism, of any good analytic frame really, is in its ability to clarify what the stakes are. What would it mean to ask the question, why is Beyoncé drawn to feminism? If this feminist world we proclaim is so dope, why wouldn't a black girl like her want to be a part of this work too? And if her husband Jay-Z's recently released confessional album 444 is any indicator, perhaps feminism helped B find her power when she was confronted with an unfaithful partner. Feminism has certainly been a soothing reminder of my badassery every time I've been forced to mend my own broken heart. Something about the thoughtfulness and intentionality with which she publicly grappled with her feminist journey makes it feel authentic to me. Yes, my willingness to believe the best about Beyoncé comes from my insistence on believing the best I can about black women. It is not a small thing to have the world's biggest pop star on our squad. There are still far too many young women who are hesitant to claim their feminism for us to be snobs about who gets to be included. Recently, I had to stage a homegirl intervention of my own for a young sister struggling with the meaning of feminism. The young woman, a student at Howard, had emailed to ask if I would come to her research presentation on my campus. Of course, I obliged her. During her presentation about her research on black girls, I sat brimming with pride at her professionalism, but also curiosity about the conspicuous absence of black feminist theorists from her presentation. Afterward, I asked her about that choice. Well, Dr. Cooper, I'm not sure about feminism. Why, I ask, even though I suspected some of what her answer might be. It just seems like black women are trying to force white women to accept and include them. I'm still not over how those suffragists treated Ida B. Wells at that march in 1913. She was right. A group of white suffragists had tried to force Wells to march in back during a 1913 suffrage march. Wells patently refused, though, and found a way to march with her state delegation. As I sat and talked with a student who had far more sophisticated reasons for rejecting feminism than I had when I was a student, I wondered yet again about why it is so easy for black women to ignore how important feminism is to our lives. I began by reminding her of the obvious. Despite white women's racism, Ida B. Wells felt she had a right to be at the suffrage march. Black women care about feminism because sexism and patriarchy affect our lives too. Then I shared with her some things I've learned on my journey to feminism. First, I'm not merely a feminist who happens to be black. I'm a black feminist, capital B, capital F. That means I learned my feminism from black women, and my feminist theory and praxis is situated in the particular ways black women have understood, thought about, and written about the problems of racism and sexism across space and time. My feminism begins not with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton showing out at Seneca Falls, but with Mariah Stewart, a black lady abolitionist who was schooling audiences of men and women, black and white, in Boston in the 1830s. When Sister Stewart asked her audience, "How long shall the fair daughters of Africa be compelled to bury their minds and talents beneath a load of iron pots and kettles?" I see in her question an insistence on prioritizing the well-being of black women and girls. When she then steps to black women and says, "We have been possessed of by far too mean and cowardly a disposition, though I highly disapprove of an insolent and impertinent one," I see her grappling with the ways that rage has been our constant companion. I see her challenging black women to make that rage count. And while I think black women have every right to an attitude problem, I get Stewart's point. She concludes by telling black women, "Do you ask the disposition I would have you possess? Sue for your rights and privileges. Know the reason you cannot attain them. Weary them with your importunities. You can but die if you make the attempt, and we shall certainly die if you do not." This is my black feminism, the kind that is going to channel all this rage to either get free or die trying. Second, I have too much feminist shit to do to spend my time hating white women. Anytime a white woman says something wrong in the public sphere these days, there's an army of black feminist writers at the ready with think pieces that can snatch her wig and have her picking her face up off the floor months later. Going after white women online will get you lots of clicks and likes, but you'll feel exhausted at the end, and often white women's attitudes won't have changed one iota. I'm not saying white women don't do treacherous shit. Far too often they are straight up enemies to the work of ending patriarchy and racism. But we still can't let white women become the center of a conversation that isn't about them. I have had other black feminists drag me, or try to, when I have said this. They have said I'm caping for white girls. Have you met me? Black feminism is not a reactionary project. It is not about the damage that white girls do. Not solely or primarily. Black feminism is about the world black women and girls can build if all the haters would raise up and let us get to work. When I talk about owning eloquent rage as your superpower, it comes with a clear caveat that not everyone is worth your time or your rage. Black feminism taught me that. My job as a black feminist is to love black women and girls, period. The third thing black feminism taught me is that I was once willing to let a black nationalist-centered politic, largely narrated to me by black men, have me put my own political needs and concerns on the back burner to center their needs and concerns. It's odd in this political moment that black feminists resent white women more than black men. Because when I think of the harms I've dealt with and who has caused the most pain, done the most emotional and physical violence, it is always, always, always black men. They have done the shooting, the cheating, the beating, and the devaluing. Yet, when a young black man gets killed by police, my ass is in the street proclaiming that black lives matter. When black women get killed, black men never manage to plan such marches in solidarity with us. Though our bros ain't loyal, we insist on showing up for them. In a world where capital B blackness matters as much as it does, I'm not sure that this obviously contradictory approach to our feminist politics will change. Where brothers are concerned, shit is and will always be complicated. After laying all this out, I realized that I sounded like a feminist evangelist and that perhaps I had hemmed the girl up a little too hard. So I backed up and simply urged the young Howardite not to leave her intellectual and political heritage at the door because of the ways white women often act. She listened to me, but she still looked skeptical as hell. I guess I deserved it for all the talking crazy I did way back when. This is why I worry about a black feminist politic that spends all its time tearing down black girls who aren't deemed radical enough on the one hand and white girls and their relationship to racism on the other. Stewart didn't say we shouldn't give white folks the business. She said the opposite. But she also reminds us that black women and girls should be at the center. My black feminism keeps my eyes on the prize being black women and girls. My black feminism insists that we center them, that we talk about them, that we build a world for and with them, that we fight alongside them. Black feminist rage can change this world, but it can also destroy us if we are not careful. It's just that powerful. It's powerful because the power of a good political analysis is that it can be a masterful cloak for the emotional work we haven't done. Look, I know the world is not black and white, but for black women, our relationships to white women and black men are still the primary definers of our feminism. Being in solidarity with the Latina chick or the Asian American chick in the struggle feels not uncomplicated, but sensible. It's dealing with all the feelings around white girls and black boys that get us all caught up. And in the midst of that predicament, black girls are always the compass pointing us to the north. That is the most important lesson that black feminism taught me. That a black girl, my home girl, saved my life. She did it by lovingly calling me out, or rather calling me in, as the kids say, on my bullshit. We need each other to survive. Strong female leads. I have a complicated relationship with white women. As clear as I am about needing black women as a matter of survival, I feel far less sure about the need to be in solidarity with white women. And no other relationship causes me to reckon with that fact more than the political rise and fall of Hillary Rodham Clinton. I have been a spectator to her political career since 1992, when her husband became the first Democratic president in my lifetime. I was 12 years old when he took office, and my conflicted, complicated feelings about Hillary Clinton are deeply rooted in the very relationships with white girls that shaped my early adolescence, which happened simultaneously with her entrance on the national stage. But first, let me tell you why things with me and white girls are the way they are. On the one hand, if my television viewing preferences are any indicator, I love white women, especially those who run shit. My Netflix queue is populated with shows that feature strong female leads, Gilmore Girls, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Girl Boss, and Grace and Frankie. I can be found on any given day watching reruns of Madam Secretary, Rizzoli and Isles, or Veep on regular television. And Rachel Ray gets as much credit for my cooking style as anything my mother and my grandmother ever taught me. I know I just committed country southern black girl blasphemy, but I long ago swapped out those delicious cans of flavor-infused, heart-clogging used grease for a bottle of EVOO, extra virgin olive oil. On the other hand, I haven't had a white girl for a friend since 1998, the year I graduated high school. The last white girl to visit a place where I lived was my friend Michelle, who famously stepped into my room one day and put my lustrous pink oil moisturizer in her blonde hair and claimed it gave her texture and body. We both giggled about it, her in delight at using black hair care products and me at the absurdity of this white girl, my friend, putting my pink oil in her white girl hair. Real friends can share cross-cultural intimacies like that. But until the Netflix user algorithm clued me in, I had no idea that I had a predilection for watching white girls run the world. How can an avowed black feminist be in love with imagined worlds in which white girls are at the center of everything? It all started with the Babysitter's Club. Well, really, it all started with Tammy Brown, a poor, mousy brown-haired white girl who could have fit the description of Ramona Quimby in Beverly Cleary's Ramona books, which I loved. Tammy screamed the words, "Dirty nigger," to me on the playground at recess. When I was 8 years old, I only registered nigger, a word I had heard my father use before among his friends as an insult, because it spewed forth from the beet-red, angry, scrunched-up face of this white girl. She delivered it with such force that my body recoiled from the shock of it, even though I wasn't fully aware what she meant. That night, I came home and asked, "Mama, what does the word nigger mean?" Before my mother answered, her face winced in pain. I had never seen that look before, but I registered that she hated hearing and knowing that her daughter had been called such a thing. Mama stopped stirring the pot on the stove, looked at me intently, and replied, "An ignorant person. A nigger is an ignorant person." Tammy Brown may have been ignorant, but she had just initiated me into a world of racial knowing of the worst sort. White girls were still kind of new to me. I had only recently started spending any significant time with them socially after my first grade teacher discovered that I was an advanced reader. That meant I could no longer stay in my disproportionately black middle ability track elementary school classroom. I was moved to the predominantly white upper ability classroom. Mandy, whom I met in second grade, was my best friend. She was nice to me, and we ended up playing together at recess every day. Mandy invited me to skating parties and church cookouts, but then there was Tammy, who looked at me as though my skin was shit-stained brown. My newfound